My name is Scott Hasserud, and I'm going to say "Ready, Betty." That means that Betty gets to turn on the machine in the back room because we record these sessions. So everything you say is on tape, so. The reason for recording them is that we want to give opportunity for those who may not be able to join us this morning to be able to listen to the conversation sometime else during the day or during the week. This morning we're going to be working together on the prodigal son. Have any of you not been with us before in our Bible studies, two or three? Well, welcome. Let me say just a quick word about the process. We use a very subjective style of Bible study, which is only one way of doing Bible study. It really presupposes a lot of the hard work that the scholars do in helping us understand the historical context, the literary context, and so forth. But our attempt is to try to internalize these symbols and to see what they mean with us. So I'm going to be asking a number of questions about this text this morning, encouraging you to respond in any way that comes to you. There are no right or wrong answers here, and only your responses. A couple of rules we have is that if anyone disagrees with anyone about anything, we encourage them to speak to them privately about that, but not to take them on in the context of the group. On the other hand, if anyone says anything that's meaningful to you and grips you, and you say, "Yeah, that's what I was feeling," that's a helpful thing. You're welcome to it. You can have it. As I often say, you can steal it. And you can even say it sometime in the future as though you thought it up yourself. So you're welcome to it, any insight that comes along. So we encourage you to be courageous and just say whatever comes to your mind and your heart in relation to the text and the questions that are being asked. It's as though we want to put the text inside ourselves and let it stir us up and say things to us that are important to our own personal next steps, our own personal growth. I'd like to begin this morning by sharing with you a reading from Oscar Wilde, who, as many of you know, was an English playwright. And he wrote these words: "It is tragic how few people ever possess their souls before they die. Nothing is more rare in any person, says Emerson, than an act of one's own. It is quite true, most people are other people. Their thoughts are someone else's opinions. Their lives a mimicry, their passions a quotation. Christ was not merely the supreme individualist, but he was the first individualist in history. People have tried to make him out as an ordinary philanthropist or ranked him as an altruist. He was really neither one nor the other. When Christ says, 'Forgive your enemies,' it is not for the sake of the enemy, but for one's own sake that he says so, and because love is more beautiful than hate. It is his own entreaty to the young man, 'Sell all that thou hast and give to the poor.' It is not the state of the poor that he is thinking, but of the soul of the young man, the soul that wealth was marring. But while Christ did not say to people, 'Live for others,' he did point out that there was no difference at all between the lives of others and one's own life. By this means, he gave to us an extended, a tightened personality. Since his coming, the history of each separate individual is, or can be made, the history of the world." Interesting statement. The history, each separate individual is or can be made the history of the world. Okay, we'd like to jump right into the Prodigal Son this morning. It's so rich with imagery for us and provokes us in so many different ways. Would someone read for us at least the first part in Luke 15? Incidentally, this is another example of Lucan material, material that's peculiar to Luke, that we don't find in Matthew or Mark. It's another reason why many scholars feel that Matthew and Mark did not know Luke when they wrote their versions of Scripture. Because, as we noticed yesterday, the Samaritan's story is not included anywhere else. So also is the prodigal son. Okay, who would read for us? A volunteer?
Do you want the Good News version?
I think I prefer the RSV since most of us have that.
You know? Is that what this is?
Probably.
Okay. The whole thing?
Yeah, well, to verse 24. Why don't we do the first part?
And he said, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, he said, How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him, and had compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to his servants, Bring forth the best robe, and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be married.
Okay, very good. That's not the RSV, that's something else. But that's interesting. Let's work with the word inheritance first. What does that word refer to? What is an inheritance? How would you describe your inheritance?
Something that is passed on from parents to children.
All right. Okay.
I think we first think of it as money or something, property, something
okay.
like that.
All right. That would be the first thing we would think of, wouldn't we? But what else could it be? What are these somethings that are passed on?
I suppose that inheritance has the same root as heritage, and that includes where our parents and grandparents came from and what they brought with them from there and what they passed on to us, more than just material things, but all kinds of things in their whole culture. Including their religion, their faith.
All right.
Traditions.
Okay. Traditions, attitudes. Okay. Our heritage. That's interesting. I wonder if there is a connection. I never looked that up. In between heritage and inheritance. Sounds like it might be related, huh? Could be. Okay. What would be the content of our inheritance? What do we receive?
Certain values.
Values? Okay.
Whatever is shared.
in the past and the present.
And it's a gift rather than deserved.
Okay, it's a gift, right? Given to us.
We haven't worked for it or earned for it. We have no right to.
Right. What things are contained in a will besides?
Who gets the feather pillows?
All right.
Property.
Okay.
It's interesting that the older brother felt he'd been discriminated against, and yet actually he had no right to the material that was given until the death of his father.
Okay.
Special keepsakes.
What is the significance of those? Memorabilia, the grandfather clock, the keepsakes, the feather pillows.
Sentimental value. Okay. Things that have sentimental value and some that have real value too.
But more often than not, it's the quote sentimental value. Right? That's important in those things. A certain plate that, you know, that mom always had, that milk glass plate that maybe she got from her mother, you know. What's the significance of that? Would you say? It's more than just a plate, right?
Memories. It's a sentiment attached to it. The fact that it belonged to somebody else that loved, you loved, and
it tends to bring continuity.
Okay.
Roots.
Roots. Connects us somehow
with the past.
Somehow it symbolizes something about all those people, right?
They give us identity.
Yeah.
Relationship with them.
Okay, I don't even know how to ask this question, but someone this morning staff said, what is in the will of God? I thought, now, wow, that's an interesting question. I never thought of that before. Well, we can all fool around with that question. What is in the will of God?
That you can have everything I want you to have.
And eternal life.
Okay, yeah. So that's interesting. Okay, what would it mean to ask for your inheritance? What would be involved in asking for your inheritance? Either from, let's deal with your parents first. What would it mean to ask for your inheritance? What would be involved in that?
I think it would be embarrassment.
All right, you'd be embarrassed, okay. Okay.
So they can't leave fast enough because you're innocent.
Okay.
You might get less than you would.
Okay.
You might not get anything.
You might not get anything, all right. But what might be involved? And let's push that around. That's an interesting. What would it mean for us to go and ask for our inheritance?
I used to do that. My mother had a bracelet, and I can remember saying, "Mom, when you die, can I have that bracelet?" Until I was about 10, and she finally ripped it off and gave it to me, somewhat angrily.
Okay.
I think now understandably.
There are. I have some friends, several friends, whose parents have given away what they own during the course of their life rather than after their death. So it's, I don't know if that's becoming more common.
If it's spontaneous and not sought by the kids, I can see where that has some merit. But when the kids come to ask, to me this is just the old head of covetousness.
Okay.
Pointing, rearing, and suddenness. Okay. All right. And then the kids come and ask so as to beat out the sibling.
Okay. Alright.
They want the favor, right? Whatever, you want to be favored. But I have thought of this too from the standpoint of my parents. What's theirs is theirs, to do whatever they want to.
Okay.
It's absolutely wrong for me to sit there with covetous eyes, mm-hmm. desiring what they have. Mm-hmm. They worked for it mm-hmm. as something of their life. Mm-hmm. If they want to give it away, they can do that. If they want to burn it, they can do that. If they want to give it to the church, they can do that. Mm-hmm. And I should let them.
Okay.
There's maybe more grief in these problems concerning inheritance in the world today than if there wasn't anything to pass on.
Okay. Yeah.
It's irrelevant, but it's something to stick to that. So a bumper sticker, we said, we are spending our children's yeah. inheritance.
I've seen those in the South. I saw one the other day on the back of this big RV. It said, we are spending our children's inheritance. Okay, let's dare to be irreverent. What could some positive qualities be of asking? We've identified some of the negative poles, but what might be some positive possibilities of asking for our inheritance? Possibilities. You don't have to agree with any of them, but what might be some positive?
Have the enjoyment of seeing us enjoy it.
If they grant it, too.
If they grant it, yes.
Okay.
And if they felt that way.
Tax advantages.
Okay, there are tax advantages, right?
And I think they could use it for a good purpose.
Okay.
It isn't necessarily to do it.
Yeah, the college has no qualms about asking people for their inheritance. Alright. Okay. What might be some positive possibilities of asking for your inheritance?
But the question almost makes it sound like you're entitled to it. And I have a little problem with that.
Okay.
My parents don't owe me a thing except to raise me, give me food, clothing, shelter, the necessities, plus education. When I'm out of the nest, they don't owe me anything. I'm not entitled to anything. So what, if I come asking for something, I'm entitled.
What would it mean to ask for your heritage? If we define inheritance in larger terms than property and money and some of the other things that some of you said,
seems like a lot of that has already been given.
Okay.
That I don't know if you would necessarily have to ask for those things which are not property or money, but that is something that has been probably shared with us throughout our years of growing and being within the family structure.
Yeah.
That's probably something that we not only have already gained, but continue to gain without necessarily even directly having to ask for it.
Okay.
Sometimes without being aware of it.
Right.
Maybe though, maybe our parents haven't really faced the issue of not being around forever. And so that if we ask for our heritage, we ask them to take the time to think what they have that they haven't given. The stories, the memories, the wisdom that they always were going to tell us but haven't done it yet. And I feel really sad about the talents and stories and memories and wisdom that doesn't get shared, that they forget that they're not always going to be around, and there's so much that people need to hear before they're gone, so that they know, so that the children and great-grandchildren and know who they are and know where they came from and know what happened before. And so it seems to me that if we ask for our heritage, we can give our elders permission
to give, and then I think that also gives them permission to go. I think that a lot of elders hang around because we are afraid to let them go.
Okay. So it could be, you could get that which is going, that which has already been inherited in perhaps a more conscious position somehow, or we could become more aware of it, to ask for our inheritance. My guess is we all do that. You know, we sit down with dad or mom and we say, tell us about Aunt Minnie and where she came from. Or, you know, what do you know about? But it might also have something to do with getting to a new relationship with that which we have inherited, acknowledging that we have a certain heritage. There are certain givens that we haven't earned, they've just been given to us. Things like what? Character, someone mentioned, and so forth.
Values.
What?
Values.
Values, yeah, right, values were mentioned. And so forth.
In scripture, yea, I have a goodly heritage.
Yeah, okay. So I think it's a fascinating question to ponder and reflect on. What might it mean to ask for our inheritance? Now suppose, just suppose for a minute that we did go and ask for our inheritance and our parents gave it to us.
May not last long, right.
How would that change our relationship? How would that change things for us? Or wouldn't it?
This could be positive, but it's difficult. I'm then really forced to face inevitability of their death.
Okay. All right.
As long as it's theirs and it's in their hands, it's like there's kind of that illusion that things are going to go on forever as they are.
Okay.
It would make me feel very responsible.
Okay.
Someone. Responsible for everything I do.
Okay, because you know that that's
theirs.
It, right? Oh, plus it's theirs. Yeah, it's not only has it been given to you, but there ain't no more after that's gone, right?
You're the keeper.
Yeah.
You become
what?
You become sort of the keeper.
Okay.
Of maybe of their property or whatever, but you become sort of a keeper of the traditions that they value. Things that were Aunt Minnie's and Grandma's and whatever,
right.
Those kinds of things that are being passed through have now sort of shifted to you, so you become a much more, could become much more responsible.
Right.
Joel suggested might become more irresponsible too.
Well, now they're recommending that you give your home 3 years before you have to go into a nursing home to your children so that the nursing home doesn't
End up with it.
It has to be 3 years before.
I don't know if this has anything to do with this, but this came to my mind as a positive. My husband and I don't have any children, and we, you know, everybody should have a will, and we haven't done that because with what we have, we can't decide who we would like to give it to, or when we sit down and we discuss, well, you know, so-and-so and the family could really use this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, I don't know if I want to give it to them because I think they'll just squander it and buy TVs and what I've worked so hard for, I don't want it to just be squandered. And we have just been going back and forth trying to decide. And, you know, inevitably we just never sit there and actually make a will because we can't, you know.
Maybe a suggestion there that I've heard. Consider your church as your family. And if you give it in that direction, it'll have good use. congregation, not for the operating budget and that kind of thing, but seminaries, colleges, nursing homes, some of these places where it'd be ongoing and good.
Okay.
For the son in this parable at the time of Christ, I'm just guessing, but I wonder if that wouldn't have meant a cutting off, but once the father had given him the inheritance, that maybe he had no, I mean, in the society that day, he had no further obligation to the son, and that the son had no right to expect anything more from the father. He had received what was his, and that was the end. So in effect, it was cutting their relationship.
Certainly their relationship would get to a different place, wouldn't it? I mean, they're still father.
They wouldn't be father. I mean, they're still father son, but they're not either.
Yes.
Yeah. They finished off what had to be done.
Maybe it makes an adult-adult relationship possible between them.
They have these books out now about parenting your parent. And I think that that's the other thing is, having done that, then the roles might become reversed. And the parents may, in fact, find themselves needing or being dependent.
Well, it's an interesting question. To ask, what would it mean to ask for my inheritance, both from the standpoint of the son and the standpoint of the parent? Perhaps the parent has to consider what they have and what they'd like to give. It's an interesting question to think about. What would you like to give your offspring? And particularly if we can expand the notion of inheritance to be larger than our material possessions. What might it mean to ask God for our inheritance? Have any ideas about that? I don't think many, you know, that's not a question that's probably asked.
Well, if we say to God, give me my inheritance, and God says, yes, these are my gifts to you, but they include these responsibilities. And sometimes those responsibilities are such that we say, well, just keep your gifts.
Just keep your inheritance. Or just keep your... I don't like your will.
Well, I think that's true with our parents, too. Okay. Their responsibilities come with
them. Aren't we getting his inheritance all the way through life?
Yeah,
and there's a crumbling.
But being parallel to the parable is asking for the inheritance, meaning I want it all now, and I'm not going to depend on you anymore. Now I'm going to be my own boss, and I'm going to do my own thing, and I'm not going to have that dependent relationship on you. And I think that's what we sometimes do to God. We try to assert ourselves.
Okay. That could be a negative quality, although it's interesting. Of course, we know that the story ends where the son and the father have a relationship. It's different, but they still have a relationship. We'll go on, but I'd like you to reflect on that. It seems to me when you ask for something, it does make it conscious in a way in which it might not be conscious otherwise. You it helps get it defined what it is, some of you may have had the experience, perhaps not of asking your parents for your inheritance, but asking them what the nature of it is, and that you want to talk to them about it. I've had that experience My father, at the age of 75, remarried. And I had to go talk, I felt compelled to go talk to him about my inheritance. Because I had some strong feelings about what he was planning to do with it that I didn't agree with. And so I finally, after wrestling with it for a long time, decided that I just need to go share my feelings with him. And that was a frightening experience for me, but it all worked out well. Part of my feelings came from the fact that I didn't think my mother would agree with what he was planning to do with it. And so it gets to be a tricky business. Okay, why did this son need to leave home, do you think? He left home. He needed to leave home.
He felt he was too confined.
Okay.
Maybe it was, it had something to do with the feelings toward his older brother.
Okay.
All right. Brother wanted to have a good time.
He wanted to have a good time. Okay.
There was no place for him.
That was a tradition in our Scandinavian heritage, wasn't it? Wasn't it the oldest son received the farm and the rest were to fare for themselves? And so a lot of them came to this country for that same reason.
I don't know if it's in human nature, but I'm just thinking of how that fits with so many myths and fairy tales, especially the sons, not so much the daughter having to go out and seek their fortune.
Okay.
It's that breaking away from.
Okay. Why do they have to do that, do you think? Why do they do that in those stories?
Becoming their own person, separation, being finding who they are, who they are separately from.
Somehow it's integral to coming to oneself.
It seems to be. It seems to be kind of woven through so much of history and legends.
What would it mean for what has it meant for you to leave home? Again, we often think of leaving home in geographic terms. You know, we leave the house that we've lived in and we move someplace else. But maybe leaving home is something that we all have to do in other ways. What would it mean to leave home? What would it feel like to leave home?
Lost.
Okay, lost.
I
don't think I left. Yeah, I left it in a way, but I always came back and felt welcome and felt it was home.
Right.
And I think our children do the same thing. It's coming home and they just do what they want to do and then just as if they hadn't been gone, pick up where they left off.
Don't you think the clue to that is loving acceptance stuff?
Okay. You mean that exists in the home?
When you have to get the same street address.
Yeah. Okay.
But for some people, leaving home isn't a sad thing. It's a free thing. It's finally getting free, finally being safe, finally being able to get out from under something that's really hard. Homes are not always wonderful places.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a sense, there was a legitimate leaving of home, which a man leaves his father and mother and goes with his wife, but this was, in a sense, and the condition of that time illegitimate, because he was just going to be on his own completely,
okay,
without a sense of responsibility to try anything else,
right,
except himself.
Right.
It's unpredictable, too.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's going to happen, yeah. Yeah. I think for many it's probably a frightening experience, unsettling experience.
Painful.
Painful experience.
I was going to say probably both more parents. So for the parents.
Yeah. I thought I was ready for my son to leave home until he left home. Then I realized I wasn't ready. You know, this kind of agony in me. Is he going to make the right decisions?
I don't know if it's just conditioning or not, but it seems much more reasonable in our society, at least, or much easier for the young to leave than for the old to let them go.
Our communication is so good. When this young man left home, he was to put a phone every Friday and say pray for us if anything.
He really left home.
I think most of, I'm first generation American. My mother came over in about 1915, so there was still good communication.
Yeah.
But had her parents come over, when they left the old country and they came to this country, there was just really little contact after that. They were just gone.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah, a lot of our ancestors, when they left home, they really left home, didn't they? And many of them never got back.
No telephone calls.
Yeah, and no telephone letters is about it. Sometimes they'd take months if ever. Okay, well, leaving home is, it's interesting though today, one of the common pastoral care kinds of problems that I run into all the time is so-and-so coming in and saying, Pastor, I've got this 26-year-old son and he won't leave home.
Yeah.
He left home, but he came back. And, you know, I don't know what to do about that. And
the only thing to do is buy a condominium with one bedroom and ask Pa.
You mean for yourself?
Yes.
You know, I see. Right. So to get the hint, huh? Okay. So that's kind of a new emerging problem, which is interesting. But it's also really interesting to ask this question psychologically, what does it mean to leave home? And so even though we may have geographically moved out and lived someplace else, what does it mean to leave home? And the paradox is that often if we can leave home, often we enjoy home even more. When we go back and can appreciate it and see it perhaps more clearly than we did before. Okay, now this chap chooses to go to a foreign country. What is a foreign country? How would you describe a foreign country? What do you feel about a foreign?
Completely unfamiliar.
Okay. What is a foreign country?
Where communication is difficult because you don't understand the language.
You don't. It's a place where you don't understand the language. Okay.
And customs,
right. The heritage is different.
A lot of things different from what you're used to.
And the diet.
The diet is different. What you take into yourself. Okay. What do you often? Yeah.
But you're also perceived as a different person than you are by the people that know you in your own group.
You are a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as well.
You
as
are a foreigner too.
So for this son to be an opportunity.
Something that we probably don't see too much of because our country is all Christian is that some countries have several different faiths. I think by India they has like a lot.
Okay, what could it mean for you to go to a foreign country, other than geographically? I mean, maybe that's involved too. But what might it mean for you?
Lonesome.
stick.
Okay. What might it mean for you to go to a foreign country?
Frustrating.
All right.
Or it could be a new perspective.
All right.
Or a new way.
All right.
Learn something, to learn to approach things and do things in ways that you haven't thought before.
Okay. Participating in some of the forums here at Holden could be going to a foreign country.
I think one of the things that I've always experienced about travel outside of the United States, and probably more is most of us feel that, and it hurts me to talk about it, but I don't think you ever appreciate what you've got or your home or friends or family or surroundings or the identity that you have as an individual more than when you are in a different place or travel there for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or a month or a couple months or even a year. And then come back to your original surroundings. That I think you have a sensitivity to yourself and your surroundings that you never had before in the
So one of the things going to a foreign country does for you is you gain clarity about some other things. About where you've come from.
Puts a lot of things in perspective.
Puts a lot of things in perspective.
Okay. There are adjustments even when you move within your own country, but certainly when you move to a foreign country.
Right. Somebody in the staff said, I moved from the Midwest to California, and that was like moving to a foreign country.
Well, when you leave your own home and you get married and you're establishing a new home, well, now when I look back at it, I think, how did I ever dare? You leave that security and you're going into something that you don't know how it's going to turn out. Yeah. It's a gamble.
That's right. Our young people, I think, going off to college in a sense is going to a foreign country, and they're exposed to a lot of new ideas and new thoughts and perspectives that are strange. That seems strange to them.
Sometimes I think going to a foreign country isn't necessarily a choice. I'm thinking about a person who plans to always be married and suddenly finds themselves with us. Or a woman who plans to always be married and finds herself suddenly divorced.
Okay.
I think that in your own house where you've always lived, it can become suddenly very foreign. In your own life that it's always been seeming to be all the same, suddenly it's very different. It's not the same. I think that you can have foreign countries within yourself when you get a new perspective. You may have always had one way of looking at your life, and suddenly something happens and the externals aren't the same, but you are different somehow, and that can be feel real foreign to you. You don't know the language, you don't know which way to go, you just don't know how to support yourself. It can have all those dimensions.
Yeah. Fascinating energy.
In one sense, we're always toddlers. We toddle when we learn to walk, and then we toddle when we get into preschool, and we toddle when we get into grade school and high school and college and marriage, and we toddle again when we have our own children because we don't know quite how to do it. And then when they leave home, and then finally in old age, there's more toddling, and then we're going through widowhood, it's another toddling stage. So we never get out of the toddler stage.
Yeah. Interesting image, isn't it?
I think
the
divorce is certainly an issue when you're in a foreign country. In a new situation, but people look at me in different ways.
Yeah.
And at first it's like everyone is
rather curious, you know, why? What did you do or what happened? Or,
yeah.
You know, what is this thing? And you don't really know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking too that becoming a part of Christian faith is a foreign country if you grow up in Christ. There's a real change, a real difference between growing up non-Christian and then the change in values and perspectives.
I think taking seriously what's moving inside of us can be a real foreign country for us. And it's interesting to choose to go to a foreign country. Okay, well, that's a wonderful image to reflect on. Now, what does the sun do in the foreign country? What does he do there?
He lives it up.
He lives it up. Okay.
Spends all his inheritance.
He spends all of his inheritance. Right. Well, what are some of the words our scriptures use?
Squander.
And what does he spend it on?
Loose living.
What is loose living? What?
No restraints.
No restraints.
Wine, women, and song.
Wine, women, and song. Wasn't Doug wonderful this morning?
Yeah.
Got my TV and Cadillac. Wine, women, and song.
But does it really say that?
Doesn't say anything about wine, women, and song, Cadillacs, and TV.
But that other version.
Riotous living. What is
reckless living?
What is loose living? Riotous living. What is that? What would be
no
labeled that?
No
thought
of the future. What? No thought of the future.
Okay.
Partying.
What would we would label that kind of behavior because it's what? What would you say?
Irresponsible.
Okay. We would call it irresponsible. What kind of behavior is it?
Childlike.
Okay, can be childlike. Yeah.
Childish.
Certainly behavior what? We don't approve of. It's behavior that's different from what we would consider to be the norm, right? All right.
I think everybody's secretly in the back to do it.
All right.
Oh my God. Go and blow it off.
Okay.
I like the image of the no strings, because the looseness, being no attachment, you know, free.
Total freedom.
No
responsibility.
No responsibility.
Foolish. But you know, there's a lot of proverbs about fools. But he also says in general, loose means not holding tight. You could have had an open hand as opposed to a tight hand.
Okay.
And you could have. I'm sure you did.
Yeah,
he didn't have friends.
He didn't have friends. He probably had a buddy.
Okay. It's interesting. Loose as opposed to what? Constricted? Rigid? Tight? It certainly is we would describe loose living, wouldn't we, as the opposite of all the behavior we would regard as being responsible, good, you know, creative, so forth.
There must be some of that in all of us, the writer, the work, father, of mankind, to give us foolish
ways, dangerous ways.
But Matthew Fox talks about being cruel, and he had people on staff there that call themselves professional folks. It isn't always a terrible thing to be cruel, to be, because what's a cruel? Cruel is someone who doesn't take thought to the future. But if you if you listen to some of the scriptures that say, don't worry about tomorrow, maybe it's okay to be a fool. Maybe the future is any safe then, and we need to think about it.
Okay. The Navajos have an interesting image of, if there's one that's to become a whole person, they talk about eating out of the other side of the basket.
For what is then is cautious and turns away from evil, but a fool throws off his strength and carries.
Okay. Okay.
You have to give up some dinner. That has a positive feel to it, but you have to give up some inner restraints and messages of the body. You have been brought up that this is the proper way to be in this world, where a good son acts. You let go of some of that, but that could have been free and the price to be paid. Doing that, but
in a way, if you let go not only of the material inheritance, but some of the heritage.
He spent his heritage, didn't he? His inheritance. He used it up, so he had none of it left. It's almost a connotation of throwing it off and experiencing the other side. And it says that when he did that, there was what in the land? A famine. Isn't that interesting? There was a great famine in the land after he had spent his inheritance. What is a famine? Any of you ever experienced famine?
Yeah. And a little from the media about the famine in Ethiopia and Africa. And that is bad.
Some of you may have experienced famine more in terms of hopelessness. Everything I've ever stood for has been taken away from me. Everything I've ever hoped for is gone. Everything I've ever wanted to be, or been taught to be, or believed I should be able to be, is no longer there. I think there's a lot of famine around. Some of these situations you mentioned, Janice, divorce after many years of marriage. What kind of famine, isn't it? Perhaps widowhood. What?
Wanting a child and realizing you never have it. Wanting to be accepted. And knowing that you can't change that.
I've worked with some ministers who, for one reason or another, leave the ministry either by their own choice or not by their own choice. And it just devastates everything that they've worked for. Everything that they've imagined themselves to be is suddenly gone. You know. And it's just a devastating experience. So famine, I think, is pretty popular experience. Perhaps not for us, for the lack of food, but for some psychological.
You being caught in obsessive illness, finding yourself an alcoholic or a drug addict or someone who just can't not bend it sore, there's just so many obsessive illnesses around. And just that empty feeling that you can't control it.
Coming to terms with being a sinner. You know, we know that in our head. But when you get caught red-handed,
and you have to face it, it's something else again. Then we have a chance of getting it in our gut. I often say that one of the great privileges that God has given me as a pastor is to welcome people into the human race. And so every time somebody comes in and they say, Scott, you're not going to believe this about me, I have the opportunity to welcome them into the human race. And I said, now we can forget any illusions we have about being without blemish. We're going to have to include our sinfulness and our understanding of ourselves. And we can get on with life. Because we don't have to pretend anymore to be inhuman or perfect without blemish. But we can really understand what our Lord taught us about being, saved. We can experience the grace of God that comes when we can accept our sinfulness. Okay, now what does he do? In this famine, he's spent his inheritance in loose living, his heritage. He's in a sense, one gets the feeling he's acted out all the opposites. Everything that his heritage said that he shouldn't do, he's done. Right? He's lived out all the opposites. And so, what does he do? He goes out and gets a job. And what kind of a job? A brown collar job. He gets a humiliating job. He not only even gets the worst job, but he really kind of enslaves himself, doesn't he? Attaches himself to one of the citizens of the country. And, historically, why would this be such a terrible job?
Swine for the Jews.
Yeah. He's a good Jewish lad, and he's caring for swine. I mean, not only are they dirty, filthy animals, but they're against, all the traditions, right?
And they have to eat the same food as the swine.
And he's eating the same food. There's a sense in which we become what we eat, right? What we take into us is what we become.
I don't think he did. It says he would gladly have eaten.
There's a footnote. Other ancient authorities read filled his belly with.
Yeah, it's unclear. But anyway. Okay, now what happens to him in the depth of this mud pile and famine and he's spent everything? What happens to him?
He says he came to himself.
He came to himself.
We call that born again.
All right. He was born again. Right.
It finally hit him.
What?
It finally hit him.
What hit him, do you think?
What he did.
All right.
He had to do it at home.
Okay.
He lost it.
All right. What happened to him in this muck?
Reality. That
okay.
It was all gone. He had to make a choice.
All right.
Priorities.
Okay. Say that a different way for me. Priorities.
He got to thinking about those things that had value and importance.
He got to thinking about what really has value for me, what really has importance for me. Okay.
He began to know himself.
He began to know himself.
It seems to me like he had a discovery of some kind of self-esteem.
All right.
Because he could have continued to punish himself by
right.
staying with the pigs.
Right.
But what he did is remember whose son he was. And I think that was a step up in self-esteem for him. So, well, but I'm, I am something.
Okay. He has nothing left, so there's a sense in which he's thrown back totally on himself. And whatever value there is, he's got to find somehow within himself, doesn't he? He no longer is a wealthy young man. So he can't get self-esteem from pleasing other people. Somehow he's got to find it in himself, doesn't he? He comes to know. I was going to ask you to amplify for me a little bit about know. What is that? What is the kind of when you to know yourself? But we use that word a lot, but let's push it around. What would that mean?
Maybe you look at what you've been doing, or the way you've been living, or the way you think. Examine.
So,
to kind of identify how you do make choices and how you do understand yourself, your values and all.
So you're consciously, you're a whole new relationship to. Rather than just keeping on, you're in a whole new relationship to how you do things and what's important to you and what you value and so forth. Right? Okay, any other images that come to mind of what it means to come to oneself?
A number of years ago there was a book titled Watch Yourself Go By. Not easy to do, but he came to the point where he saw what others had been seeing.
Okay. So he sees himself in a new way, doesn't he?
He really do.
I don't know why, but I always think that that term is having a sense of peace or sort of centeredness about yourself.
Okay. That coming, that involved in coming to oneself is somehow a centering, or there was a peace. Okay.
Right.
If we could, you know, if we could use the term born again to describe these dynamics, I think it would be a really helpful term. Unfortunately, in our society, it usually has meant some kind of ecstatic experience where we get goosebumps.
Well, we separate the turning around by the middle of churches,
right.
However.
Yeah.
It's the point at which you assume responsibility for your own actions,
right,
instead of doing what your daddy always told you you should.
Okay.
I work with a lot of people who are experiencing some kind of depression. And we were talking about, when does depression end? Does it end when the situation that is oppressive ends? Or does it end the moment that a person sees that they are oppressed? And then they, in a sense, they come to themselves. Like if it's a woman in a situation where her husband is beating her every day, does her oppression end when she gets away out of that? Or does it end the minute that she knows that she doesn't deserve any kind of abuse? That sort of, when does that, when you come to know yourself, when does it end?
At a woman, say to me a month or so ago, had been struggling with that issue. I forget what she'd been reading, but she said, it suddenly dawned on me that part of my problem was that in getting victimized, I had become a victim. And I have been behaving as though I am a victim. And it suddenly dawned on me I am not a victim. I have been victimized.
Well, the other side of that is that there are many people who are severely oppressed, and you touched on something too, but at some point you have to say this oppression has opened a wonderful vista of a different kind of life to me.
Okay, so in the oppression one learns, one can learn an awful lot about oneself.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
which isn't to say God wills the oppression, but is to say that, that God has a will for perhaps how we can respond to the oppression. It's quite different.
Well, I think had you no faith, had one no faith, that the oppression could continue as a bad thing.
Okay, what happens? What does he decide to do then? Out of this experience of coming to himself, he decides to do what?
Return home,
doesn't he? To go back. And so, expecting what?
He has a prepared speech. Prepared his sermon.
Okay, so what is he expecting? What is his prepared speech? What is he anticipating?
Throw himself on the mercy of his Father and say, could I do? Could I become a servant and at least have something to eat?
And how does his Father respond?
Gives him far more than he ever imagined.
His Father orders up a celebration, right?
He comes in humility, and yet he finds, you know, that he has acceptance, which he really wasn't looking for. And the Father really blows it up and makes it real important that he has come home.
And the Father says what about his son down the road? What's the important statement that his Father?
My son is dead.
My son was dead and he is alive again. He is lost, doesn't he say? He has been found. His son has gone through death and is alive. He has been lost and he is found. Okay. What does the Father understand about what has happened to the Son, do you think?
He doesn't even take time for analysis because he's been watching the road every day.
What's your fantasy about what the Father knows?
The Father knows that his Son has changed just by the fact that he came home.
Right.
The physical presence of coming back, he knows that there's been a, he must have been extremely frustrated and all the things that we talked about, the reasons, possible reasons why he left, that he was just totally unhappy. He didn't see any significance or any reason why he should be in this place where his Father is home. One, there was no meaning for him. But the fact that he came back, his Father has known that he now has come to the realization that there is something there to be gained, both from his Father, his brother, his family, whatever. There's something there that is that awareness has come to some kind of fruition in his Son. He's become aware of it, some kind of new sensitivity that he didn't have before. A realization, reawakening, rebirth.
Right.
He knows that Son has really suffered.
Okay.
And he identifies with him because Father suffers with his Son and his Son suffers. And he's mighty glad to give him that.
What's different now, do you think, in the relationship? Or will be different or is different? Mm-hmm.
Well, the Son, I think it broke his arrogance, and now there could be a close relationship with his Father. Which
you didn't probably have before. How has the Father
changed? Compassion. His love is overflowing.
How else might the Father have changed? Or the relationship changed between them?
Before, now they're friends. But the Father must have gone through a grief when the Son left. I mean, he must have experienced it as a death.
Yeah.
As a death.
Right.
So the Father had already been through the terrible sorrow of losing the Son. And so how many of us who have gone through grief can just visualize what it's like to be given back the thing that we've been grieving for.
It's a father that says, my son was dead. Right? So it's the father who thinks of it in those terms, right? And now he's alive. That is the father who says, my son was lost.
Father suffered as much as the son.
Yeah. Do you think the father knew this was going to happen? Or was that?
That's good. I can imagine that the father might have
expected.
No, might have been blaming himself. I didn't give this kid the right reason to say he's taking my money and life. Then I can also visualize the son when he hit bottom. Not coming to himself, but just being plain desperate.
Yeah.
And was sort of an animal knowledge saying, here's where the food is, so I'll go there. But when he does come back and appears changed, then I can see the father thinking, okay, I can get rid of this guilt that I maybe have been carrying. I did give him something after all. And now he's showing it.
The phrase, man's extremity is God's opportunity, this could have worked in both cases. The father might have said, what can I do?
That's a wonderful thing.
The father did some loosening himself. The son was involved in what was called loose living. I think the father might have loosened some of his. He had been rather rigid and had certain ideas of how a son should be and what his relationship was to his son. Let go of some of that too, and when he saw, I think there's a possibility he didn't know what had gone on with his son. At that point, it didn't even matter. My son is back. It doesn't matter what he's done or whether he's changed or not. It's just at that moment he's back. It's a complete acceptance.
Right. Has it been a good journey for the son, or a bad journey?
Turned out good. He'd been at the lowest depth and reached the highest.
No, he doesn't do that. He confesses, he's forgiven, and without confession, there's no forgiveness.
Yeah, has a new understanding of himself.
And he's able to get back the most important part of his inheritance to the non-material part of the
inheritance.
Okay. Is there for him to regain. And when I think of my grandmother passing, that part of my inheritance to me, I think she got a great deal of joy in giving it.
Right.
And the son is not only getting it back for himself, but in a way he's giving it back to his father as well.
Certainly their relationship is going to be different, isn't it? We're not going to have time to deal with the son who stays home, but it's a fascinating question to ask who, you know, what part of us is that? Who is the son who stays home and doesn't go on the journey? One of the magnificent dimensions of Jesus' parables that I hope we're getting a feel for is that there's a sense in which all these characters are a part of us. All of these characters. We're not just the son that went on the journey. But there's a dimension of us that's involved in all of this.
It was a dangerous journey.
Very dangerous.
The possibility of not having the reunion.
That's right. That's always there, isn't it? He could have just succumbed. Somebody last week talked about he could have just, how do you put it? Not about this prayer, but we were talking about how people get into pitying themselves And they go, call it a pity party. And he said, they don't know when the party's over and it's time to go home. They just stay at the party and stay at the party, you know. And somebody called it a pity potty, and from Eastern. Doesn't say art. That's interesting. And it's just a pity potty. Anyway, we have to get off the pot sometimes. My own feeling is that in addition to this being a story about the acceptance of God, which it certainly is, it is also one of the grandest stories of individuation in the scriptures.
What?
The grandest stories of individuation, of how we come to ourselves. Which is not to say that I'm giving you all permission to go out and live in riotous living. But maybe to try eating out of the other side of the basket. I mean, maybe there are some behaviors that we need to get more in touch with, like playfulness, instead of regarding that as irresponsible. We need to learn to play. I think that's particularly true of us serious Scandinavian Lutherans, you know.
I think many more of us are like the other side. Probably many more people.
Yeah.
And it's really dangerous because when you were talking about that, I was thinking, he must have felt very smugly self-righteous.
With one estate home.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, he had continued to do everything his heritage said that he should do. Just right.
Yeah.
Right. He would be held up by the collective as the righteous one, the admirable one, the responsible one.
But he never really felt this way.
Once a year I preach a sermon on creative irresponsibility. Or justifying, I have a lot of terms I thought of, but justifying disobedience. Or justified irresponsibility, or creative disobedience.
Creative incompetence.
Yeah, right. You know, what does it mean to try out some of those things we wouldn't be caught dead doing? Like having a good time. Or taking time for ourselves to nourish ourselves, you know. That sort of thing. We may even have to borrow some money to do that. Goodness knows we want to do that. Or something, you know, I mean to really nourish ourselves. The other great story of individuation is Jacob in the Old Testament. Prodigal son and Jacob are two of the great stories of how that move us through a variety of psychological stages in our life. And that out of that, the whole relationship with others changes. Well, it's time for coffee. Thank you for being a great group here this morning. I hope we have intrigued you a bit. And you can work with some of these own symbols in your own life, in meditation and reflection, however that is best held for you, be it through writing or art or some other ways. To get in touch more with these figures, even to dialogue with them. Have a conversation with the prodigal son or the father or the son that stayed home and see what they have to say to you. They'll say wonderful things.